Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Team Human is an ad-free, listener-supported project made possible by teammates like Nikita Sidorov, Fraser McDougall, Darren Nelson, Benjamin Dueck, Matt, and hopefully you. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support to find the others who gain access to our Discord channel, my paywalled Medium posts, archives of my collected work, and conversations with luminaries like Tim Leary and Terrence McKenna, as well as participation in our live Team Human salons in the Kibitz Room. See you in there. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, a chance to rethink the tools and technologies that are shaping our reality, recognize the patterns underlying what feel like novel changes, and retrieve the human cognition, empathy, and collectivism required to make sense and make peace with our shared condition. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, concerned netizen, media essayist, and McLuhan archivist, Clinton Ignatov.
If you're an embodied person in space and we're sharing this space together, let's explore this space together, and I'm going to grow closer to you faster by building a common world with you.
Clinton is going to be helping us understand Marshall McLuhan and ourselves in the context of the media environments we inhabit and the metaphors we use to understand them. It's time to intervene on our own behalf. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. It's funny, one of the questions I'm getting the most as I tour for Survival of the Richest is, what's your beef with billionaires? You know, like, aren't they allowed to spend their money however they want? If they want to build bunkers, they should be able to build bunkers. And I'm like, yeah, I guess they should be able to spend their money on bunkers if they want, but my problem is more with that they're earning their money in ways that then require them to spend their money on bunkers. In other words, the reason why most of these guys believe that that they need to have bunkers or rocket ships or ways out is because the business practices that they're using to get the billions that they want to spend on their bunkers are themselves so bad. It's capitalism, exponential capitalism, these desperate attempts at profiteering and monopolization in order to have enough money to escape the apocalypse. Those are what render us more vulnerable to death and disaster in the first place. Like, I've been reading a lot of Cory Doctorow's articles lately, and he wrote one thing about Epson printers and how there are these models of Epson printers that are pre-programmed to brick themselves, that is to cease, to turn off forever after a certain number of pages. And they justify that it's for some little sponge that has to be replaced, and otherwise it would leak all over the table, except there's no way to replace that little sponge, that little, you know, 5 cent or 2 cent sponge that would then make the printer as good as new. No, instead you've got to buy a whole new printer and take the printer you have and throw it on a toxic waste heap somewhere. But there's an executive who makes this inner calculation. Well, I can probably earn enough extra money selling these more printers in order to distance myself from the damage I'm creating, right? They think they can somehow, with the profit, stay one step ahead. Or John Deere. And I've come to believe this one tractor company may pose a more immediate and present danger to our lives than any of the top secret files Donald Trump stole or maybe sold to foreign governments. I mean, what Corey showed is that they've designed their tractors so they can't be serviced or reconfigured except by an authorized technician with the right computer codes. So let's leave aside for a minute the idea that the company is arguing that farmers paying $600,000 for a piece of equipment don't actually own it, or that the company can refuse to fix a dissatisfied farmer's tractor unless they agree to a gag order about the company's practices, or that John Deere's remote kill switches give the company the ability to lock farmers out of their own tractors. It's a feature that the company celebrated by bricking equipment that was seized by Russia and Ukraine. I mean, that sounds kind of cool, but the bigger problem here is the code John Deere uses to maintain all of this control over farmers' equipment. It's actually really insecure. As Doctorow puts it, he said, it's a dumpster fire of information security worst practices. He went to DEF CON last month, and he saw a hacker named SickCodes jailbreak a John Deere tractor live on stage. And what that means is that just as John Deere can lock out any farmer from their own tractor anywhere in the world remotely, a hacker anywhere in the world could lock virtually the entire American farming industry out of its equipment, right? That's because John Deere not only has machines that can be locked by a malicious hacker or government or terrorist or enterprising North Korean high school student, it also has a monopoly on American farm equipment, because they've purchased or eliminated all the competition. So the company's business practices and the underlying business monopoly, they combine to make our agricultural system less safe and way more brittle. So if the billionaires, the tech billionaires that I've been meeting are any indication, I'm guessing that John Deere executives, they have access to local farms with unlocked tractors, or more likely older pre-computerized models or ones from overseas. Or if they're not thinking quite that far ahead, they're making what I've come to call the insulation equation. They believe they're earning enough extra money through these dangerous practices to buy and hoard food if and when the agricultural catastrophe happens. So in order to protect one company's dominance over its own customers, as well as the obscene wealth of its biggest shareholders, American agriculture has been rendered open to this rather totalizing vulnerability, or even a system-wide malfunction. So the only real source of resilience would be smaller farms that use alternative equipment, or those who have gotten hackers to jailbreak their tractors in ways that don't get noticed by the John Deere mothership. And, you know, God knows what kind of security people coming to tell you you've broken your contract. And the longer term answer, of course, is distributism, or what we now call platform cooperative, or worker ownership of equipment. So imagine if a farmer's cooperative owned John Deere, or even a machinist's cooperative, instead of shareholders who believe they're impervious to the externalities of the business practices of this company. So it's not the technology itself that's the problem. I'm not critiquing technology. Rather, like the Luddites, I am a great fan of technologies that empower workers and small businesses, and a critic of those that are designed to extract value from people and places in ways that render them more dependent on central authorities, less able to exercise autonomy, and more vulnerable to catastrophe. The big difference today, the difference our technology-enthralled billionaires don't seem to get, is that the selfish decisions they are making don't just affect the workers, the customers, or the poor. They have system-wide repercussions, exacerbated by monopolies and the brittleness they engender. And the sooner they can be convinced there is no escape from the decisions they are making on all of our behalf, the more they may start behaving like they, too, have skin in this game. Because even tech billionaires have to eat.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I've met Clinton Ignatov briefly a few times at panels and readings or a media ecology conference here or there, but I hadn't had the chance to really engage with his ideas until someone forwarded me a link to an essay he wrote called Misreading Marshall, which he wrote on the occasion of the latest kind of Marshall McLuhan revival and misunderstanding. Whenever someone writes a piece about Marshall McLuhan or saying, oh, I kind of rediscovered Marshall and I think maybe he was saying this, all these people from the right and left, they all chime in and say how awful Marshall McLuhan was, that he was a sellout or this or that. Kind of a lot of like what people do to Timothy Leary, too. And he wrote a really nice piece about Marshall McLuhan and a few others. And I was really kind of moved to see someone engage with Marshall McLuhan kind of the way I do with Neil Postman, as a person with deep spiritual convictions and not some, you know, crazy techno-utopian, as people seem to misread him, but as a very concerned concerned human. And Clinton is a concerned human as well. He's calling himself a full stack media ecologist, which means he does a study of the humanities, but informed by very rigorous technical understandings of applied computer science as well as history. Connecting with us from Canada, he's really, I think you'll find him as inspiring as I do. He's in some sense undereducated in the official ways, but he really brings the true slacker ideal of rigorous thinking supported by any professional means necessary so that you've got the time to really do thinking on your own or with others in contexts that maybe no one at the academy or elsewhere would let you do. So here's my friend, Clinton Ignatov. Hi, you've been making some nice waves, I would say, in the recent and latest McLuhan revival. It's always strange, I find, when one of these dudes in mainstream journalism, like in this case, Ezra Klein, you know, it could have been Tom Friedman, mm-hmm. could have been Paul Krugman, could have been, you know, any one of these folks going, oh, you know, I think McLuhan might have been right after all. And, you know, they come up and then they come up with a nice, you know, good high school reading of McLuhan. And then some friggin' either libertarian asshole on the one end or kind of Marxist person on the other end says, oh no, McLuhan was a horrible, overrated asshole who, you know, sold out to, I mean, the teachers with me at Queens, a lot of them are like, well, how can you teach McLuhan? He sold out to the advertising industry. He was a fan mm-hmm. of capitalism. His global village never happened. We're mean to each other and in each other's business. How could you even? Mm-hmm. And, but the thing that's great about you, you admit you've only really come deep into McLuhan lately, is you've gone and kind of looked at what he's actually said and what he was doing and said, actually, there's something very, very else going on here.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so I guess I'm interested to know what and you hinted it in some of the articles you've written lately, but you know, what brought you, I didn't go to McLuhan until I was in my late 30s, after I'd written two or three books on media. What brought you to re-explore McLuhan so deeply?
It's got to do with growing up digital native, as the term mm-hmm. is, right? But sure, you know what, I got a computer at in my house, some 46 laptop when I was, you know, 5 years old, 6 years old. And the way my mother would tell a story, oh, and then Clinton was lost to the world, so to speak, right? And, you know, that's a melodramatic reading. But, you know, when you grow up your entire life online, you're definitely part of a different zeitgeist, a different story of what's going on in the world, a comment section, but behind the scenes. And now we all know that with everyone right. having smartphones and having social media, but the internet was still undiscovered and a different planet from television right up until, you know, 2015, 2016, yeah. 2017, when slowly kids got on Facebook and all these things. I was around before then. I was doing stuff before then. And, you know, you could take for granted. The news always gets the internet wrong. The news, people who watch TV have no idea what their kids are doing on the internet, right? And that's why we had this advice, like, keep the computer in the living room so you can see what your kids are doing, and never tell anyone who you are online, never give away your identity, don't tell people where you live, don't share personal information, right? Don't let anyone track you, delete your browser cookies every day, and we'll watch out for software that tracks you. Somewhere between, you know, 2005 and 2015, you know, this guy named Steve Jobs comes in and completely upsets the entire terrain of what we think a computer is, what we think the internet is. We get a whole new language for it, smart devices and social media. The corporations who were trying to create the online experience in the early 90s until the World Wide Web kicked them in the pants got their revenge and finally seized re-centralization mm-hmm. of the net on a whole new generation and a whole new population, and people like me who were, you know, playing around on you know, the Something Awful web forums or Tumblr or this web 1.0 era Wild West internet are now watching everyone else dump their whole lives and their personal facts online to feed the corporate machine and to feed the advertisers and you know, submit themselves to coercion.
It's funny because what you're describing is, I mean, the same thing happened 20 years earlier in a different way. You know, but we found the net in the late 80s, early 90s. We're on the well. We're on this network that was really hard for other people to get. So the public then came into America Online, which was, for the first 4 or 5 years, at least, this walled garden of stuff. So they would dial in, go on AOL and look at, you know, AOL's version of Sports Illustrated or AOL's version of Time Magazine. They'd be there. Guests would go, it had nothing to do with our internet. Then there was this moment when AOL put an icon on the top of their screen that basically was this picture of the world, like it was the net. And it's when the AOL plugged into the net. And then all of a sudden, our IRC channels, our Usenet, because there was no web yet. It was like flooded with people basically looking for porn. Was porn or money scams of some kind.
The driving force of innovation in technology, as the myth goes.
So it seems, but it was wild. And it was because even at that moment, a lot of us who were old, like cypherpunk, cyberpunk, crypto netty people were like, how are we going to metabolize this, you know, a population of newbies that is larger than the actual population of the internet?
Netiquette and good netizenship went out the window. Yeah. In the 90s, we never quite were able to train the incoming people.
But at least that was the internet. I mean, and yours is another one. Mm. Yours is like, so then that internet culture was then further, you know, eroded the whole landscape was changed once it was like, oh no, now this is a landscape not just for commercialization, but for extraction, control, prediction, and influencing people.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, people... who talk about social media without grounding it in the longer history of the internet, they're sort of floating, as McLuhan would say, in a figure without ground. They'll talk about, oh, this is what social media does to us, or the centralization is awful. But, you know, then you gotta go back and read John Percy Barlow in 2001 warning people about Microsoft's passport system, where you log into everywhere with your Hotmail address, and they're trying to get everyone to change their login system to be the Microsoft Internet Passport.
Yeah.
And they were just 10 years too early, because now everyone logs into everything with their Gmail account or their Facebook account or their, right? I don't. I try not to. Like, the 90s cypherpunk underground scene, it's still there. There's still lots of people out there trying to protect their anonymity. They're just not the center of focus for where the conversation is at, right? They're marginalized.
And what you say, you know, that people were very focused on the figure in media. So you're looking at, what is the net doing to us? What does social media do? It's like whatever the story is on the TV screen. Just like today, you know, it's like there's Trump, there's climate change, there's immigrants. Mm-hmm. These are all figures, and they're real. Not to say they're not real, but in an interesting way, McLuhan was inappropriately blamed for being a techno-determinist, which would be someone who looks at, here's the figure, social media, and look what it's doing to people. Here's the figure, porn, and that's what it's doing to people. Where what McLuhan was really doing was trying to reintroduce ground, you know, media, what he called media environments. So it's not the smartphone. It's, let's look at the environment of the smartphone, which is both where it came from as well as what it's doing, where, you know, what it's obsolescing and what it's flipping into. I mean, he was trying to look at it in this other way. So all of this is going on. The net is changing. The media is covering it as figures. And and you're walking in a bookstore and a McLuhan book flies off the shelf onto your head. Now, what?
No. I watching the social media world of what we can call them noobs or normies or whatever you want, right? The normalized people that are inside the Skinner box of our social media commercial internet, who buy a new iPhone every year and feel accomplished for learning how to use their iPhone. And conflate that with actual, what I would call computer literacy, because I'm a Linux nerd, right? Like, I'm taking apart my machine and fixing it. You got to get in there, get dirty. It took me years to understand computers, you know?
And I still tease people who conflate technological literacy with media literacy. It's like, I know a lot of people who understand machine language and still don't understand the impact of technologies on human psyche and culture. But that's a whole other story. But so what brought you to the mountain?
Oh, just the horror of watching mainstream institutions start picking internet flame wars with the underground scene of outsiders who have usually comprised the internet of my peer group. You know, like, so let's say if the Something Awful Web Forum people and the 4chan people, which is ancient internet history from 20 years ago that no one should care about, except that it's the origin story between what now we call, you know, like the war between the ideologies that we label alt-right and, you know, like 4chan versus, you know, Twitter users or Reddit users, right? There's a long backstory in history to this stuff that people would rather learn from an anthropology student whose narrative is done through their post hoc research into this history than the people who lived through it, who are completely socially unacceptable, right? And unqualified, right? It's a story of the anthropologist giving a report about the digital natives or the real natives, right, of a society, and getting it all wrong, and then the natives having no say in how the story actually happened because the cultural differences are too large. So I was trying to find words to explain all this, and one night I was watching weird 80s movies, and it was Videodrome, the Cronenberg film, and then it was Shock Treatment, which is a musical, and about a bunch of television-possessed zombies staring at a game show's Price is Right style, very psychedelic. And I sort of had this epiphany. I was like, oh my God, Videodrome. Isn't that McLuhan guy? I got to read him. And I picked up the Gutenberg Galaxy, fell into it because McLuhan was speaking my language. Mm. He was describing the world I was actually living in at a embodied sensory level of who I am and who all these people are and what's going on and what the TV's doing and how books are dying out. And the internet was all text when I was growing up. I learned how to type. You get in big, long conversations. Those conversations stick around forever. The social media world is a one-a-day thing. Conversations drop off. Tweets get old, right? Like on Reddit, the threads are gone in a day or two, you know?
Well, it's weird, though. It's both totally liquid and temporary in terms of its traction and intellectual, emotional staying power, but it's absolutely permanent in terms of its ability to come back and bite you in the ass when something you've said turns out to sound like something that was inappropriate.
Yeah.
Best of both worlds.
Exactly. Everything you do is being remembered and recorded and will be used against you in the court of public opinion.
Right. Even if you can't remember it 3 minutes later. Yeah.
Yeah. So groping for language to describe, you know, the troubles of, you know, 2014, 2015, 2016, the meme wars and beyond the ideological language and the ideological categories, because there's a difference. It seems like tribal affiliation is mutually exclusive, but perceptions of what's going on are not. McLuhan drew a lot on the cubist idea of trying to see things from all angles all at once. And he didn't believe that that cribbing talking points from this side when they're right and then cribbing talking points from that side when they're right was a contradiction.
Right.
There's no contradiction in seeing things from multiple opinions. But when you have to identify as something and join a tribe, now start using talking points from the other side is a contradiction in your identity, in your tribal affiliation. Now you're a double agent or an infiltrator or subverting or right. So we all still want to have a place to belong. We want to know who we are. We want a label to describe ourselves. But then that mechanism psychologically, especially with the internet, where you are, the first thing social media wants you to do is pick a flag and pick a side and go follow all these people so that our algorithms can see who it is you follow and determine where you live in this weird abstract space of left and right and authority, right? These political compasses and all these games people play to figure out their identity and these psychometrics that they take, right? Once people learn who they are in those terms, they can't broker any exchange or conversation with anyone from outside of their tribe.
Right. And you felt like McLuhan saw this tribalism coming, certainly.
Oh, he saw it happening. I mean, he was reading people who were seeing it happening in the 20s and 30s when he was a teenager.
Right.
That's the thing. We've been doing this forever. I mean, McLuhan's writing in the 40s and 50s and 60s about this stuff because he's reading about small magazines and underground press-style blog-like publications from the 20s and 30s in England and in Europe, right, in literary reviews, right? So culture's been doing this for so much longer than we'd like to think.
Yeah, and he's reading guys, I mean, on the one hand, he's reading guys like, you know, Mumford, you know, who had a lot of that sort of red state, blue state tribalism thing figured out in the 10s and 20s. But then he's also reading like the weird old back and forth between people, and I know it's even mentioning these names is trouble, but people like Belloc and Chesterton. Mm-hmm. And really, it is interesting. It is, you know, as you put it, it is like going back and looking at a really smart person's BBS or blogosphere, you know, the way that blogs used to kind of all comment on each other, or the arguments that you could go back, and there's some of us who do like doing that, going back and looking at how the birth of an argument on Twitter and seeing the back and forth as a sort of tragedy or comedy of errors. These guys were doing that, whether it's Dewey and Lipman or Chesterton and Belloc or, you know, Swift and that. They're having these really heated arguments about important issues. They just happened slowly because it was at the rate of print publication.
Yeah, exactly. Which, again, is not often too bad, right? And, of course, the internet just recaps these things at a slightly faster scale over and over again. You've got email threads on or message boards in the 80s and 90s and Usenet and news groups and these things, right? So it's like we keep telling ourselves this story over and over again, and we keep having these conversations, and then the media changes and things get faster. And do it over and over and over and over and over again. And already by the 60s, McLuhan's going, oh my God, this is too fast. It's instantaneous. It's all at once.
I know.
Yeah. He's describing his time, but when you read him, you think, wow, he's predicting our time, because it feels like what he's saying is more true now than it was 40, 50 years ago, right?
Right. And that's the thing. He's not this futurist. But so the people read McLuhan to this day, or they talk or a little bit of McLuhan or about McLuhan, or they see one thing. Maybe they'll read the first 500 words of his famous Playboy interview and they'll say, oh, yeah, McLuhan is saying, hey, man, it's all okay. TV's coming. Hippies are coming. LSD is coming. It's all just fine. And commercials are media, too. Just chill out, man. Tune in. Turn on. Drop out. I'm with Leary. You know, let's go to Woodstock. Wise up. Hip, get hip. And as I understand it, McLuhan is kind of saying the opposite, that McLuhan is jaw dropped, looking in horror at the loss of what he saw as almost medieval values, the commons, the handwritten manuscript, the thoughtful headspace of true literature.
Yeah.
Right. He's in some ways an arch conservative bemoaning. I mean, he goes all the way back to bemoaning the Protestant Reformation and the printing press, right?
Yeah, absolutely he does. That's so he was a rhetorician, and I mean that in the classical sense of having studied Cicero and Seneca and like ancient pedagogy from Greece and Rome and the medieval ages about how to write sermons in the 1500s, right? So he knows how to speak, how language is used to speak to the public, and he's watching all of the thinkers of his generation share his sentiment of staring at horror at what the kids are getting up to nowadays and throwing away their books and running to drugs and stuff. And he knows that if he becomes a bitter crank, if he remains a bitter cranky old man, then he's going to get sidelined and written off.
Right.
If you want that story, go check out the obituary for Harold Rosenberg in the New York Times. He was a very influential thinker. He was important. He was a big art critic. He explained action painting and modernism to the world. And then as he started to lament the state of art and the consumerism and the people selling out and the superficiality of it, the New York Times is like, oh, this is a bitter old man who's not with it. Yeah. He can't get it anymore. He's all dried up, you know. Good riddance, right? And that was the public attitude to people who couldn't get with it.
Right.
And McLuhan realized, I got to get with it and talk to these people in their language. You got to meet people where they're at. It was a Christian attitude of being in the world while not being of it. And you got to be in this world. And you got to be.
So on the one hand, he's talking with hippies and going on the Today Show and hanging out with Leary. And on the other hand, he's at the University of Toronto having lunch with the brothers, with the monks every day. You know, it's like he's not hanging out with the TV scholars, if there even was such a thing. But the thing, I got to go back, because you say McLuhan's a rhetorician, right? And I know our friend Mark Stallman would say, oh, no, he'd say, no, he's a grammarian, right? Do you understand that? That's sort of the trivium and these different things. And
yeah, see, that's a big issue with McLuhan's scholarship, is that one of the most important books for understanding him, his Cambridge University doctoral thesis. Didn't come out till like 2008, 2007.
Yeah.
And so people who have been studying McLuhan for years don't have the story of where it all started. So McLuhan is a grammarian in the sense that he knows how to read. He knows how to read. And that means literally read, because he studies poetry. But he knows how to read the book of nature, as they would say back then, which is, he has perception. Our senses don't merely reveal to us the world as it really is. We learn to make sense of the world, as constructivist theory would hold, right? Like, if you want to read Piaget or something, right? How is it that we learn to make sense of the world? We have to train our perception. It's a constant act of learning to see behind the illusions and see behind the superficialities and get to the bottom of things. And McLuhan worked very hard to tell people, if you want to get to the bottom, if you want to train your perception, stop looking at the superficial images on the screen and look at the fact that you're sitting alone in a room with a blinking box.
Right.
If you want to get to the bottom of things, stop paying attention to the content and say, what am I doing here with this device that's, this illusory device that's tricking me, right? As a grammarian, he's trying to incentivize people to learn how to read. His books are complicated and hard to read to get you to slow down. To learn how to read, to how to feel the shape of what one word next to another word and what metaphors are, and to see the metaphors that we use in our life that mislead us from getting deeper into what we're actually doing.
Right. And I guess he would probably blame, because the same period I get upset about is the shift from sort of medieval to Renaissance or craft to industrialism, that he would blame that sort of industrial mindset from the 12th, 13th, 14th century, that it turned reading and everything into its utility value. So books became more like the instruction manual that comes with a piece of technology, and you're reading it for the facts or the recipe. And it's like, no, you don't know how to read. You are sitting with these black swirly things that were put there by someone else next to each other to convey this, let go, be with the book,
Absolutely. So you've got these books full of know-how and cynical or pragmatic step-by-step stuff. And then, you want to feel something? Here's a gushy romantic poem about flowers and trees and all this nice stuff. But the two are two completely different genres. That's what happened after eventually McLuhan blamed the printing press.
Yeah.
But you're right. He's got this great early essay that no one's read because it's in the archives here in Ottawa called Dale Carnegie, The American Machiavelli. And he rips into Dale Carnegie as just the most monstrous thing that could have ever happened to all the people he knows who are running around reading this best-selling book. And he's going, oh my God, this is the most cynical, awful, dehumanizing approach to socializing.
How to win friends and influence people?
That's the one. Yeah. How to win friends and influence people, right? That was atrocious to him. But he ties it back to Machiavelli and King Lear and Shakespeare. And this is just a repeat of what happened, right? This book that reduces how to be a prince to step-by-step instructions. Well, if this, right, that depersonalized the monarch's relation to their people into a cynical attitude, right? Pragmatic, machine-like, right? It's the same deal. That was his whole...
I know, but so in some sense, so McLuhan is in some ways the original member of Team Human, right? Looking at the anti-human effects of industrialized technology and new forms of media, and certainly arguing none of these new forms of media necessarily have to do this if we understand what the medium, if we understand the messages of the media that we're using, then we can adjust accordingly and titrate them and introduce them in a more conscious way. But so here he is, the original digital humanist, and he ends up somehow on the masthead of Wired magazine as the patron saint of a magazine whose very purpose was to take the hippie qualities of early Mondo 2000 psychedelic digital technology and repattern and reconform them for the market, for market free market libertarianism. How does that happen? How does he get seen as the day glow advertising corporatist patron saint of the techno-libertarian, techno-solutionist Wired magazine.
Well, he was playing a fine line by trying to speak to the kids in their own language and be value neutral. Mm. So he's trying to explain the kids in the go-go boots at the dance floors dancing to the Supremes, right? You can see footage of this, and clearly he doesn't want to be there, but he's going, oh, look at the way the children are inhabiting their own little private world as they dance around in their heads in their own pod, cut off from everyone else, right? All right, just extremely value neutral, right? So he's not saying it's good, he's not saying it's bad, he's just describing what's going on,
right? Which is dangerous. I mean, I tried to do in early Q would say, oh, look, this is the realization of a kind of an interactive novel. You know, finally, people are getting to do a fantasy role-playing game where they're assembling data. Yeah. They're doing the yes and architecture of comedy. And, you know, yeah, if you're content neutral, the activity itself is interesting. So how do then I would pivot to, so how do we, you know, get them to do this or help them do this in a way that's constructive? You know, how do we incorporate some of this into our progressive and leftist thinking? And but there's almost no way to do it without everyone saying, oh no, Rushkoff's praising Q. It's like, oh, you know.
Or, right. Yeah, exactly. You didn't come out of the gate disavowing and you know, yeah, exactly. That's McLuhan. That's the trap McLuhan was falling to in the 60s. Mm. And what happened was he got translated into French, and that became McLuhanisme. And the way the zeitgeist over there rolled, he ended up being the naive optimist compared to the more realistic Jean Baudrillard, who anyone who's seen the Matrix films, you know, you can see Neo's got Baudrillard's simulations and simulacra in his desk, right? Baudrillard's is the cynical realist against the naive, optimistic, techno-utopian McLuhan, and that's just how the story rolled. And so within our culture, that's sort of how McLuhan is remembered for everyone who doesn't try to read his very difficult to read books.
So here you got Baudrillard. I mean, God bless him, he did great things. Baudrillard and the sort of the semioticians of postmodernism, mm-hmm, in France calling McLuhan abstract.
Right.
It's exactly. Like, oh, pardon me. So here's the guy who's saying, wait a minute, return to the ground. What's happening on the ground? What's happening in your hands? What is the television doing to the neurons in your eye? You know, different from what, mm-hmm, the book did to the neurons in your eye. How does it, you know, he couldn't be more on the ground, literally ground, getting blamed for being the abstract. It's so, you know, and that's why I'm in one of my greatest honors was I was at, what was it? That conference they do in Ars Electronica. I was there and I did some talk. And then Manuel de Landa is doing this interview of Paul Virilio on a big screen, who's, ooh, coming in. And Manuel de Landa says, so what do you think of these sort of media virus ideas of Douglas Rushkoff? And Virilio goes, Rushkoff? He's an idiot. And so he didn't know I was there. But I was so honored that Paul Virilio even knew who I was and what I was doing. But as you describe it, I'm like, yeah, it's that same thing. The French kind of postmodernists see this sort of analysis or misinterpret this analysis as acquiescence to the decadence of these new forms of media rather, mm-hmm, than our effort to kind of forge a sense of continuity and pattern recognition so we understand, no, new media is not novel. It's always, mm-hmm, new media. It's, you know, yeah, it's just, yeah, it's another new media, you know, and that's not accepting. It's not value neutral, if anything. And this is again where McLuhan gets into trouble, or Postman or me. It's religious. It's spiritual.
Oh, it is. It is. You have to take it that seriously. I mean, this is something that Camille Paglian was nailing 20 years ago when she's pointing out the Hollywood star system and the rock and roll cults as a revival of paganism. Mm. It's this idea that the way we turn people into icons for worship, for fandoms, right? The entire fan culture situation is a very interesting, powerful force in our lives. And, And again, I'm trying to describe what's going on without making value judgments one way or another. And right, it as a lifelong Star Trek fanatic, right.
I'm thinking, you know? And that's where you get back to. It's like all religions are fine as long as you don't actually believe in them, right? So you know, it's sort of like even all these fandoms. I could be a Miley Cyrus fanatic, and that's fine, and put posters all over my office and listen to her music all the time, and as long as I understand that I'm creating Miley Cyrus, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's it. Well, I mean, there's so much money to be had by incentivizing super fans into buying and owning every little thing that it's a very difficult cycle to change. McLuhan is very hard to read for a completely different reason that the postmodernists are very hard to read. The postmodernists, as you pointed out, they've got this idea of semiotics or sign systems. All words point and signify things, and then you know, here's how these words form structures, and here's how these structures unconsciously shape our perception.
And it works almost like math, right? It's schematic.
Yeah,
it's work. It's just like the digital humanities people can say, I'm going to count the number of thous versus the number of thines in Macbeth.
Yeah,
and it's there, digital humanism or digital humanity. It's there. Whereas this other stuff, McLuhan stuff, is much more squirrely.
yeah, because he goes back to the Middle Ages, and what he's retrieving there is analogy and metaphor and a nuanced sense of how everything we say is a metaphor anyways. And so he's making new metaphors. That's the poetic method, is to find new ways to juxtapose any given word with any other word and see what meaning you can release from these juxtaposition of words. McLuhan is he studies poetry, and he wants people to look at literature and to read word by word by word, and to milk the juxtaposition of word by word by word, and to choose every individual word they use carefully for its sonority. I mean, if every advertisement out there was just buy our stuff, it's good, we wouldn't need to pay advertising executives and creatives to come up with jingles and slogans and catchy phrases that stick in your head. The best poets all sold out to advertisement, as the socialist Charles Fourier was complaining in the early 1800s, right? Our poets are writing for these commercial enterprises to explain stock prices of, you know, pork bellies are flying through the roof. Like, no, they're not really flying through the roof. Who hired this poet to try and sell people to affect the commodities markets, right?
And when you talk about the juxtaposition of words next to each other, you are also describing what the folks do who do neuro-linguistic programming and behavior design. It's all about how do you take two words. You know, I remember the NLP people came to me when I came up with media virus and say, you've done it, that's a great neuro-linguistic programming thing, like smart drugs and all those ones. You know, you take two words and throw them together. Global Village was another one, and it creates a new socket in the brain. But the problem is that
social media.
There you go.
Social media.
Exactly. But when that craft is co-opted by behavioral finance people and or advertising or marketing, then I hate to say then we're all lost. But it's just surrendering the development of our collective cultural psyche to the needs of the market. So it's gonna steer it in a very particular way. I mean, did McLuhan critique capitalism per se exactly, or was it more just the industrialism and efficacy?
Well, he was saturated in the literary magazines of the 30s and 40s, and if you read these magazines, most of them are available for free online. If you read the Partisan Review, they're full of Marxists debates and dialogues and analyses. So, like, he never used the word capitalism, though. I never see him critiquing capitalism.
I couldn't find it either.
He'll decry the commercial attitude, the consumer attitude, the machine-like, you know, or like he'll describe everything that Marxists complain about in their critiques in terms that clearly differentiate him from the tribal allegiance. And I think that's got a lot to do with what I was saying before, where he didn't want to have or own a label as an identity, and he didn't want to signal tribal affiliation with anyone. And so if you can, and the poet's job is to take people's perceptions and give them new language to break out of their habits of thinking. And so he was sympathetic, I'm sure, to lots of Marxist critiques, but he didn't think that that people were alienated because of their relation of their dissociation from their relation to the value of their work. You know, he didn't see the fluctuating, right, the fact that the price was divorced from the value of the labor or whatever it is that Marx and Engels said alienated people. That wasn't his thesis. He said reading books was alienating people from their senses. He was blaming art, people's relation to their media so I think he didn't share the theoretical underpinnings behind Marxism as an explanation for what it was Marxism was diagnosing. He was looking at it from a different axis.
Right. And if he had an economic perspective, it was, the thing I've been writing about the last 10 years, distributism.
Yeah.
It came from the Catholic Church, this idea that no business needs to be bigger than it should be to conduct its business. You don't grow for growth's sake. And the idea that workers should own the means of production, which is not exactly Marxist. Marx would nod to it. But, you know, when the popes came up with it, they were thinking of it as an answer to both capitalists and Marxists and as to what is a proper way of doing business. That, well, as long as the workers own the means of production, as long as they own their tools, then let them compete with each other and make as much money as they want, because they're not being abused by someone who owns, you know, who owns the factory and hires them. He was basically arguing for platform cooperatives, mm-hmm. 60 years before the term was invented. So he got out of that.
Absolutely.
But who was it that wrote that really mean tweet about McLuhan after the Ezra Klein thing? So Ezra Klein comes and does a pretty gentle and I would say fairly accurate assessment of, you know, McLuhan as an important McLuhan, Postman, Nicholas Carr. I think he might have mentioned Borstens, the image in there. I mean, there's a lineage of folks of which I would argue we're both, included, even if we're less, famous or smart, that we're part of this movement to understand new technologies and media in the context of a flourishing interhuman society and sensibility. So Ezra Klein sort of says, oh, I guess I was wrong. This stuff's kind of important. Media do have biases. Okay, mea culpa. And I'm going to hop on that intellectual bandwagon, maybe a little too obviously or somehow or self-servingly, but still, it's all good. And then who was it that said McLuhan sucks?
Yeah, no, Steven Pinker, the Harvard University linguist, cognitive scientist. He jumps out in the blue and just rather just dismisses McLuhan as sympathetic to fascism and mysticism and then Michael Shermer from the Skeptic magazine jumped on board. Oh yeah, McLuhan, I bet you Daniel Dennett could put him straight or something like this. And then
I know, which is interesting. So it feels like, and I write about this in my new book, In Survival of the Richest. There's this scene when I'm having this big argument with Richard Dawkins and some of those scientist guys where they're calling me like a spiritualist and a moralist for believing that there is some, spiritual dimension to our reality, that there's stuff going on here that can't quite be explained purely in terms of mechanistic scientism, that there's other meaning systems we can use. And they're just slamming me as if I'm the enemy of the state and the future and reality. I'm a crazy, superstitious witch doctor. And it felt to me like that's what they're angry at McLuhan about most of all, is that am I allowed to even say this? Is that he believes in God, right?
cardinal sin, right? Yeah. I grew up in the rational online right, the rational atheist community, which is mostly comprised of Americans who had to escape their crazy evangelical parents and move to the coast, and now they're online processing their you know, how dumb creationist young earth stuff is, and anti-evolutionary stuff. So now,
in between their ayahuasca sessions,
right, exactly, everyone's trying to find themselves. So I understand the rational community very well innately, of having been a part of that for years. But what ends up happening is you end up externalizing, just in the same way that that economics can, or a business can externalize the environmental damage they do on their balance sheet, right? That the costs get paid for by someone else, so they turn a profit, right? Highly rational, scientific, logical, atheistic thinking of in that degree ends up externalizing people who embrace metaphor and see resonances and coincidences everywhere as mental illness, or in the French sense of the word, schizophrenia, because the French have a different relation to Sigmund Freud than the English do. In America, Freud is strictly, psychoanalysis is strictly for doctors and the medical profession and the field of psychiatry. But in France, it's, artists can study Freud and they can talk about schizophrenia, and activists can do this, right? That's the history that Sherry Turkle goes into in her early stuff.
Right. What's interesting, when you talk about it like that, it feels like, that McLuhan's truest kindred spirit would be like Robert Anton Wilson, says, is Sirius the star actually doing this to me? Well, maybe not, but a lot of people kind of think so. And it's a really interesting way of understanding the world, or even, I don't want to get McLuhan in even more trouble than he already is, but even Aleister Crowley, who's saying, yes, but no, but maybe, but...
Hey, in for a penny, in for a pound. McLuhan was studying the modernists, and the modernist poets, look at W.B. Yeats, was seeing spirit mediums, and...
Right, they were typing on their
thing.
Yeah,
they're all a bunch of occultists, these modernists, and in McLuhan's doctoral thesis that I already mentioned, he was analyzing alchemists in the 16th century as grammarians who are trying to study the book of nature, the same way that Pliny the Elder did. Like, medieval science was all alchemy and trying to find the metaphors and the analogical proportions to square the circle and find golden ratio hermetic stuff, right? He was all about that, as it was being used by poets to make their create their poetry and create balance and proportion and find the perfect analogy so that T.S. Eliot and James Joyce could go and do all these amazing poems and books in the 20s and 30s that he loved so much, right? So McLuhan was neck deep in that stuff as an artistic practice. And then I think around the 50s, he's like, oh, these guys are taking this seriously, aren't they? Oh my God, I gotta change my approach.
right? That's what keeps happening.
Oh my God, these are a bunch of occult mystical people. They're trying to create like some sort of weird ass religion. Oh my God, right? And so, he sort of like straightened up and sobered up and said, what am I going to do about this? Well, let's analyze how the medium of delivery for our, as Camille Paglia puts it, the pagan revival of Hollywood and fan culture and the sense of religious communion that we get from participating in the zeitgeist. It's when he says the television creates, or the electric environment, because we could talk about the radio in the 20s and 30s, right? He creates mass man, right? He creates humans into a mass. He's really talking about the Catholic mass, the sense of spirit and communion building and the melting into the group that goes on at any given rave when people are doing Molly nowadays, right? Just but the search for involvement that you get from now picking up your smartphone and feeling like you're tapped into the current thing and you're not missing out. He saw all of that in religious terms because of the way he saw these techniques being used in these senses, like you said. So yeah, it's all part of one story in his head, but these are things that when we talk about them, we fracture them up and it doesn't add up within a rational framework where we try to find connections and we don't feel the resonances, man, that he was trying to get us to develop a sense for.
Right. We didn't get the vibes that he was putting down. but Not that everyone has to know, pick up McLuhan and read him today. What I'm wondering from a human and experiential perspective, I mean, how do you move through the world differently as a result of the insights that you've kind of gathered from his work? And how do we, in other words, I'm interested in that. I mean, for me, when I tried to describe it at the end of Present Shock, you know, because Present Shock is a very McLuhan-esque sort of book, looking at what's happening right now and the collapse of time and all. And at the end, I start talking about pattern recognition as sort of one way to move through it and to sort of move through the world with a softer focus. In other words, rather than living in a strictly expedient kind of cause and effect reality, start being open to other causes, right? In a softer sort of, have a softer approach and listen to people differently, not just to what they're saying, but really be there. And if you're in communion with others, if you connect and establish rapport with others, another kind of communication happens, whether or not you agree with them. And, you know, those were sort of where I'm wondering for you, particularly as you were, you know, deeper into the tech and from the next generation of, you know, I was a TV kid who migrated to the net, you know, again, to the chagrin of parents who thought I was going to become a Dungeons and Dragons, you know, master as my job. You know, people hated computers back. They really had no idea what was coming. That's the way I'm alive today, is I could see at least that much. But how do you move through the world with a more McLuhan-esque sensibility? And how does that help you on a day-to-day sort of level?
Yeah, the way that I've learned to relate to people is to share a common scene, a common environment that we live in. You don't understand someone by trying to understand them. That's a big problem. We have to, oh, what's your type? Are you an ENFP or INTJ?
Is this person
high in agreeableness? Are you a Capricorn, right? Everyone's trying to understand people by figuring them out. What you do is you stand beside someone and you survey the scene, the room you're in, what the people are doing, right? You build a common sense of what's going on around you, because I'm an embodied person in space. You're an embodied person in space, and we're sharing this space together. Let's explore this space together, and I'm going to grow closer to you faster by building a common world with you, by looking at what's out there. I'm not focusing on you. We're both focusing on the world together.
Right, which is the opposite of the Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is to be like Clinton or Trump. And when people describe what it was like to be with them, why they're so charismatic, they would say, oh, he looked at me like I was the only thing in the world. He was totally focused on me, you know? Whereas the kind of friends I love being with are the ones where I no longer exist. Right? Where I disappear.
Yeah.
You know?
And now you're free to do anything, or you're free to go along with stuff, but right, then you can lead somewhere too, because you're leading somewhere. You're not being yourself. You have a place to go, and right, you can bring your friend with you, all right? In speech, in thought, in tentative, yes. And so that's what the focus on the environment means to me. I don't want to go around slapping smartphones out of people's hands and demanding that they read Richard Stallman and go send money to the Free Software Foundation, even though I think they should.
Yeah. Exactly. Right? But I gave all the royalties of one of my books. I gave it to Free Software Foundation. You know,
it's like, wonderful, yeah. Right? Right. Like that. That's what I believe in. But right, then again, if that was my tact, I'd be a real misanthrope for all the people who don't right, want to hear it, right? Instead, it's, you know, where are we? We're sitting at a bar. Yeah, what's going on, right? And I feel like focusing on the environment you're in is sort of a return to embodiment. And focusing on, I don't want to say going like one level abstracted, because you're right, like my media ecology, I've been trying to find my own words to throw together, to try to be poetic. So I called it full stack media ecology, because in the long run, people need to be able to go down the computer stack from the high level of manipulative stuff that changes every week, every time Google or Facebook changes on their software to be easier to use or more addictive or anything, right? You need to be able to go down the stack to the fact that these things used to be called personal computers because you owned it and you told it what to do, and it's a programmable device. And your book, Program or Be Programmed, right? You own this device and you should be programming it. And I don't even mean learning how to code. I mean, at least choosing the software you use and not having to use the app from the top 10 list. The same way you shouldn't have to read whatever book is popular on the top 10 list. I worked in a bookstore for 5 years. I've seen a lot of top 10 list books come and go, right? And here I am in the library trying to chase down books that have been out of publication for 70 years.
But it's about more than technological or content liberty. It's about cognitive liberty, right? It's not a matter of just which programs you use and letting them pick that, but the fact that now you're using programs that are programming you. You know, you don't know how, it's the device is operating the human.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, that's something I sort of always saw everywhere tacitly, but then how do you approach that humanely and without, right? I think a lot of the misanthropes on the internet who get cast as extremists in any direction just walk around and think everyone around them is an idiot.
Right.
That's what being a misanthrope is, right? You think everyone else is an idiot who doesn't know what's going on. Don't they see what's going on? Oh my God, I can't even stand these people. I can't listen to them talk. They're so, every single sentence they say is wrong and I'm just going to give up on it, right? And that's trying to analyze people, what's wrong with people. And that's trying to think in terms of conceptual models. And my model's right, your model is wrong. And it's, you're not present in those moments. You're fighting a dialectic in your head. The idea of my ideas are right, your ideas are wrong, right? This form of arguing where you never meet the other person either in the place where they're at, or you're never really talking to them. You're talking a straw man of them in your head. You're just projecting, right? So why you need all three: grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic, right? I can claim McLuhan was a rhetorician because he was that too. He was a grammarian too. He was a dialectician too. You need all three.
You could be more than one thing. You mean like I could like put on a Mets hat in the morning and a Yankees hat in the afternoon and still be the same person?
Depends who made it to the playoffs. But oh yeah, why not?
My God. I know. But that's back to Crowley. Aleister Crowley said to buy two rings and have one ring when you want to manifest like your evil personality and another ring when you want to manifest the benevolent one, and just see and see how you are, see how you're different in the over the course of the day. It was funny. But what I didn't ask is, so what do you do? How do you stay alive? What's your like career and what are your sort of ambitions with your work moving forward?
Right. This is all a hobby for me. This is something that I like
living
to do
life
publicly.
Life itself.
Life is a hobby. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to return to my stasis pod as soon as we're done. No, oh heck, I sell beer in Ontario. It's a fun part-time job.
You sell beer? How do you sell it? In a bar, or do you bring it to places?
Bottle or can. I work at the beer store. I work in one of the greenest companies in the world. We recycle all the packaging that we sell.
Wow. So you got it as a job. You didn't start the beer store. You got a job.
No, I didn't. Oh, no. I what I'm saying is that, like, I just work a humble, minimum wage job, and then I do this on the side. I'm not in school. I got no prospects, but I'm an internet junkie who's been watching what's going on, and I'm like, what can I do with my magical machine that connects me to everyone and everywhere and gives me all access to all the libraries in the world? Well, I can go study this thing in my spare time and become good at it and reach out to random people and talk to them, so I'm networking at scale, but I'm not going anywhere with it. Like, it's just something fun I do when I get home from work and get home from the bar. If I took this seriously, this whole, like, hey, let's go, like, email famous people and tell them what I think, I was thinking at the time, like, I could get like full of myself. I'm a chill guy. I got Slack. I'm pretty casual. I just take it easy, right? So yeah, it's fun to see the opportunities that are open in the world. But as of yet, I don't feel particularly, you know, I sort of don't like the ideological saturation at universities right now, and don't feel like paying money to go get demoralized.
Right. You go get demoralized so that you could then teach others in a system that's trying to demoralize them. Yeah. It's tricky.
Yeah.
I mean, luckily there are, you know, I do feel there's more room for citizen scholars now. I mean, you're obviously welcome at the Media Ecology Association and all those McLuhan-esque places. And, you know, Bob Logan is up there somewhere in Canada, and he started a second sort of media ecological journal They have explorations and they have new explorations
and very new explorations.
very new explorations.
The field is burgeoning. It's blossoming right now. Yes, absolutely. And so it's an exciting field to watch and to be a part of. And I'm just going to keep writing and keep talking to people and keep networking and see what happens.
You're always welcome in one of my classrooms.
Thanks, Doug.
It'd be very fun if you're even in New York or get you down. I'll bring you and expose my students to a bartending McLuhanite.
Yeah, I'd love that.
So thank you, Clinton, for being on Team Human. It's great to have a citizen scholar who is modeling, you know, what to me is the ultimate, the lifestyle that I aspired to when I saw Rick Linkletter's Slacker for the first time. I was like, oh my God, you could just live a life, learn stuff, talk with other people who are learning stuff. And what more is there? How much better can it get? So thank you. You're an inspiration on many levels for me.
Thanks, Doug. I'm happy to talk. Hit me up anytime, and that's to you and anyone listening.
All right. Then we'll see you very soon. And thank you for being on Team Human. Our guest today was Clinton Ignatov. You can find out more about him by going to concernedmedicine.com or coming to teamhuman.fm and clicking on the links, where you can also become a supporting member of the team. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.